call Resource Committee to order. For the record, Senator Frank, Senator Menard, Senator Cotton, Senator Jones.
Present.
Today's agenda, we have HR 39, Diomede Bowhead Quail Allocation. We have new substitute for Hospital 49, slow leaching DBT based paint. And Senate Bill 27, fishing business tax credit. We'll take up HR 39 right now, the Diomede Bowhead Quail.
Senator Jones, members of the committee, this is John Walsh. We're not a talk of this. Okay, John Walsh, and I'm with Representative Foster, the sponsor of this HR 39. The situation is that Little Diomede in the Bering Straits is unable to hunt the bowhead whale because it has not, or was not, a party to the subsistence documentation study done some years ago that enabled the communities that do hunt their allocation. So, in order to grant a Diomede an allocation, the International Whaling Commission and the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission need to certify that Diomede has a traditional use, customary use of the bowhead whale. The study is being done. The financing came from the Bureau of Indian Affairs and administered through the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission. And the anthropologist is doing the documentation and has prepared a draft report. He presented this draft report to the American delegation, to the IWC, and just recently, in fact, and I just got a call today from the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission in Barrow saying that it was received favorably. However, they would like to take a little bit of time to run this by the International Whaling Commissioners prior to putting it on the agenda. So it would be listed on the agenda as a discussion item. And hopefully have action next year at the International Whaling Commission meeting, their annual meeting. That's a bit different than the resolution as it's written. So if it would be agreeable to the committee, I would like to work with the committee secretary and propose a couple of line item amendments and have this prepared and ready for action maybe in January of 1992. And that way we would be in step with the IWC efforts to, or with the commissioner's efforts to present this before the IWC. The amendments are very technical in nature and just sort of house cleaning. On the second page, line 4, we would strike the May meeting because we're not going to make that May meeting. We put suggested, and this can be worked out, for consideration at the commission's annual meeting, and then semicolon, and that's, and strike, or its consideration will be postponed for another year or longer. And then another issue would be line 6. They did, Beverly Greenwich, who is the executive director for the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission, indicated that although last year's population census showed an increase, this year's will probably show just a stable population. So we would say that this would be maybe a suggestion would be a healthy population instead of saying an increase in, because it may have taken a temporary plateau there. So it's not decreasing, that's for sure. It's just not necessarily increasing anymore, or at least at this point. So with your, if there's any questions, I'll be happy to answer them, but basically that's just recently a recent development, and I just want to bring that to your attention. And the urgency of the resolution has slid up because of that. The resolution? Okay. It's from the back.
Well, we don't have any problem in holding the resolution until
okay.
We're ready. We don't want to put it out until the time is right. So
yeah, I think
that's kind of up to Representative Foster how.
I believe that was the advice we got from the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission, and
right.
I think it's a matter of protocol from on an international level. So if this were to be passed out, it would reach the commissioners on the international level before maybe the skids have been greased, if you will, or something to that effect, and they wouldn't have had a chance to bring it over, discuss it with the committee members.
Comments? Well, what we'll do, we'll hold it, and we'll work with Representative Foster on any amendments.
Okay.
Bring it back for the committee.
Okay. It was basically an oversight at the time that they did the study. They couldn't get to Diomede, and once it was not included, they were not eligible for an allocation. We're just following up from about 4 years ago.
Right.
So thank you for your time. Appreciate that.
Thank you. We'll close the hearing on HGR 39. We'll open the hearing on Senate Bill 27. Fisheries Business Tax Credit. Senator Zaroff,
long road to go here. Thank you. For the record, Senator Zaroff, Senate District 10. And what basically the CS does here, and I know that a number of you have had the opportunity to see something like this before. It was something, a measure that passed this body last year and didn't quite make it through the other body, although it supposedly should have. And it's a 2-year extension on the raw fish tax credit that we had started a few years back. Was originally intended to be a 5-year program and ended up to be a 3-year program. And what I'd like to do is go back and finish those final 2 years. And in the Labor and Commerce Committee, there have been suggested amendments by the department that they probably would wish to address. And I think it cleared up some of the concerns and questions that that people had in regards to the tax credit. And there's not much more, I guess, I could add to that other than I think it's been a very good program. I think that we've seen, as a result of that, a lot more fisheries activity on the shore, and particularly out in the westward, southwest region of the state. There's been a tremendous amount of fishing activity. And now with the North Pacific Council looking at offshore, onshore allocations, it's going to be more important there that we have shore-based facilities that are capable to process and to handle the fisheries out there. And I think that although there is an expense that the state may incur at this time, since this is based on the raw fish tax that is levied against the fishing industry, half of that money, as you're aware, goes back to municipalities. The remainder stays in the state general fund. And what this program does here, it allows the tax credit to be applied to that portion that comes back to the state general fund. And I think once this program is finished, out of the way, that the return to the state is going to, well, it has increased significantly. And I think a lot of it is due to this type of development. So I can answer any questions, or certainly people from the department are here.
All right. Thank you, Senator. We have people from Revenue and Commerce and Economic Development. And Bob is here from Industry. They are available for questions.
Chairman, could we have just an explanation, perhaps, of what the Labor Commerce did? Maybe somebody here that worked on those. Maybe Carl could explain those to Mr. Chairman.
Okay, for the record, I'm Carl Olds with the staff of Senator Zaroff. The changes Labor and Commerce Committee made are on page 1, lines 9 and 11. The highlighting didn't come through on the Xerox copies that you have on that. But not lines 9 and 11, in the middle of the sentence on line 9, it says, for capital expenditures only for the equipment and improvements that are placed in service by the fisheries business no later than the last day of the first year for which the credit is claimed. And that was a request by Department of Revenue for a placed in service rule. They wanted specifically stated in the law when a credit qualifies, when a credit must be used to qualify for the credit. Okay, on lines 13 and 14, we added the phrase, and the approval of the application for credit may be modified or revoked by the department at any time. And that's to provide notice that when a processor gets pre-approval for a credit and then goes through the project and there are changes from what was originally approved, the department has the authority to change its previous approval of the credit. Sort of a notice to the processors that they need to be careful with the department. If they don't feel that their approval was followed, could and can come back and change their original approval. On page 2, line 28, it says seafood marketing assessment under AS 1651-120 or a tax imposed by this title. Under the current law, prevents fisheries business from claiming the credit if there are arrears on their fisheries business taxes. What this does is also add in the seafood marketing assessment and the salmon enhancement taxes along with the fisheries business taxes. So if you're in arrears on any of those three taxes, that would tend to disqualify you from the credit. Okay, on line page 3, at the top of the page, lines 1 and 2, the addition of the language fisheries business claiming the credit allowed by this section must submit an application for the credit on that form. That's just clarification. Originally, the bill just required the department to prepare an application form. They wanted a sentence added that saying that the credit has to be applied for on that form. Also on page 3, lines 24, 25, and then lines 27 and 28, this is a language, just for consistency, they wanted this language from the previous section added to the tax credit for scholarship contributions, and that's just that the approval of the application credit may be modified or revoked at any time, and that taxpayers are liable for also seafood marketing assessments and salmon enhancement taxes. And those were the only changes.
Was there a change on line 27
in page 3? Yeah, a seafood marketing assessment under AS 1651-20 or a tax imposed by this title.
Senator Cotton?
I'm just trying to understand this. On page 1, the amendment there for all the... I just don't understand that, exactly what that... The new language starts on line 9, where it says for capital expenditures. Is that the new language?
Yes.
So how did the sentence used to end?
The sentence used to read...
Okay, here, I've got it now. Okay. I'm just having a hard time placing, putting this in order here on a calendar. It says for capital expenditures only for the equipment and improvements that are placed in service by the business no later than the last day of the first tax year for which the credit is planned. I'm sure if I had a calendar or some graph here, I could understand that more easily.
So in other words, if you could claim a tax credit over a couple of years in the case where you would normally go over the 50%, but you can use an unused portion into the following year if you would otherwise be go over 50%, if I'm not mistaken on that. But you need to put it into. You can't claim it before. You got to put it into place, at least in the year that you're claiming it for. You can't. You couldn't get to whatever the taxes due. Say in our case, IRS, April 15th. Put it in place April 14th and say claim my tax credit for a previous, on my previous year's income tax.
I'd have to done it by December 31st.
Right. Mr. Chairman, people from the Department of Revenue are here and will certainly answer any questions about any of these.
I don't know. We're afraid we'll have to answer. You mailed out the questionnaire?
We mailed, we did a questionnaire. When was that?
1989.
This is 89.
Right.
Well, I guess I wasn't all impressed with the results of the questionnaire. If only 33% bothered to return, so only 33% apparently were interested. And many of them say that they didn't. There's a couple of these here. Did the tax credit encourage processors to invest onshore rather than offshore? 61% answered it was not a factor. I don't know. That's what the complaint I've heard about this over the years is that, for the most part, these investments are going to be made anyway, and so why should we, you know, forgo the tax revenue if these improvements were going to be made anyway? I guess that really kind of gets to the point.
Well, this is just basically a policy call, you know, people have different pieces of legislation in to do different things, and this was something there that we thought would help the fishing industry, and I think in my estimation it has, and a lot of it depends on the processor, the size of the processor, and whether they were actually planning on utilizing, whether they responded or not. And we tried to cover as much of a statewide canvas on the questionnaire as possible, and a lot of times there with your smaller processors, you don't have time to fill out questionnaires. I get questionnaires in my mail today, I don't even fill them out. Because the time, if it gets to you at the wrong time, you just don't have the time to do it. If you're a much larger operation, you got an office that's separate from your plant, then you have the ability to fill it out.
I see a lot of people are sending money in questionnaires these days, and encourage people to fill them out.
I haven't received those yet.
I haven't. Get cash money in my house.
I think, Mr. Chairman, that the program has worked fairly well.
His opinions are worth more than politicians.
See, Mr. Lauber back there, maybe he may wish to
share some more guilt on those things.
Rick, are you going to make a comment on that, on the importance of the program, or?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rick Lauber. I represent Pacific Seafood Processors Association. Let me first state the Pacific Seafood Processors Association has not taken a position in favor or opposed to this bill. I believe we probably have processors that are on both sides of the issue. Getting back to your question, are you referring to a question that was raised by Senator Cotton regarding the effectiveness of the other bill? I can tell you about that, and PSPA did support that bill. And the only thing I can tell you is that while in representing a client, a business client, a lobbyist has to be, or should be, relatively careful in painting too rosy a picture as to the outcome. At least I've always felt that way. And so I was very cautious as to my support for the bill, as to what I projected it would do. And I must tell you that what it did do was far greater than I expected it was going to do. And I thought it was worthwhile passing, even under the narrower benefits, if you like. Having said that, I think that Senator Cotton is probably correct in that, and we never, ever left any implication that there would not be some, many, maybe significant numbers of people who would get a windfall from this, and that they were going to do the job anyway, and they would they'd get a tax credit for it. There's no way around that. But the thing that we were trying to do was to attract processors to come on shore at a very crucial time, and also to upgrade facilities into new product forms. In those sense, we were successful. There are a couple of plants that I'm reasonably certain would not be on shore today if it were not for the tax credit bill. Now, that doesn't mean that they shared the majority of the tax credit. They certainly didn't. Others got tax credit. But the benefit to the state, and let me make this clear, those of you that were in the legislature at that time, and as today, if you pass a tax credit bill, or when you pass this tax credit bill, the one we're talking about in the past, you didn't do it to benefit the seafood processing industry. If that had been the reason, I'm quite sure it would never have passed. And the reason for this bill today is not to benefit the seafood processing industry. Whether we support it or don't support it, I think is immaterial. The important thing is whether it's a benefit to the state of Alaska, and if it is, it should pass. If it's not, it should fail. But the last bill in the long term will be of significant benefit to the state for no other reason than by coming onshore, these plants pay taxes. If they had gone offshore, they pay no taxes to the state of Alaska. And they pay no taxes also to local communities as far as sales taxes. And they pay raw fish sales taxes. And they pay no property taxes in the state of Alaska. And most of them, by the way, don't hire any Alaskans. And they get very little support from Alaska. Some of them do make applications for loans, I understand, from ADA, but in any case, that's a negligible benefit to the state, I would assume. I think in all that the legislature would not have any difficulty defending its position, as in the long term, the last tax credit bill would be very beneficial. The main reason for some of the opposition to those that just are ambivalent about it is that it has to do with other problems within the industry or within government. As you're well aware, Department of Environmental Conservation is a problem for any industry in the state of Alaska, and it's no exception in the seafood processing industry. I doubt there are some processors that, one quoted, I wouldn't build a doghouse in the state of Alaska right now. And I don't care how many tax credits you give him, I don't think he's going to find a client very attractive. But that's not everybody, of course. There's always somebody that's willing to buck into an agency like that. And I think that this probably would, on balance, be a benefit to the state of Alaska. There's a lot of like Senator Zaroff said, allocation out there that we're going to need shore-based processing. The way the allocation will, even if there's a 50% onshore allocation, if the onshore plants do not process it, then they will release it in the third or the fourth quarter to the factory trawl fleet, and they will pick it up. So we have to have adequate capacity in both the Bering Sea and the Gulf of Alaska to process the product. And otherwise, it rolls over to the factory company. As they say, for guys that have a position, I said an awful lot, but officially, I don't have a position. Do you have any questions that I could? Any other questions?
Sure, got it.
Well, it's a great subject. I'll talk all day on it. I've heard people say that. That's not very important. What about, you know, this business about onshore, offshore? I mean, the council obviously hasn't acted yet. Are you willing to predict now that they will act and they will give 50% of the pollock to onshore?
Well, Senator, being a member of that council, and even though I'm the chairman of the council, you members are members of the deliberative body, and sometimes I'm sure you find it difficult to predict what your other senators will do. But it has, at the last meeting, we met in Kodiak 2 weeks ago, and the inshore-offshore issue went out for public review or public comment. After the 45-day public comment, it comes back, and we'll take final action on that in June, at the June meeting of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. Most of the Alaskans are supportive of it. One's a little shaky.
Is that right?
Well, he's difficult to pin down under any circumstances. And we won't mention any names, but he may be holding out for something. But anyway, even without that one Alaskan, I think we have enough votes.
There are 10 votes plus the regional director.
Well, there's 11 votes, yes.
So
including the regional director.
So the regional director, then there are
Six Alaskans.
Six Alaskans, plus the regional director.
That's correct.
And four from, but three from Washington, one from Oregon, or?
Yes. Well, there's one at, one at large, and then there's the Washington, there's the Oregon, Commissioner Fish. And then the Washington Commissioner Fish, like the last Commissioner Fish. Blum and Rozier, who now has a designee, Clementillion, and Oregon has their Commissioner Fish designee, with Bob Mason.
The reason I brought that up is that if we're going to assume that that's going to happen, and then as a result of that assumption, pass a bill like this, it will increase the onshore capability, or capacity, I should say. I don't know what more is needed. What is the capacity? What is our onshore capacity right now?
Well, it depends on what you're talking about. I think that there's probably a strong possibility in the Bering Sea that we may have the capacity to handle the pollock onshore right now. That isn't necessarily the whole issue. One of the great benefits to the state would be is if we could get into secondary processing. In this case, with pollock, we have the capacity to primarily process pollock in the Sereni or Phyllis or whatever. But there's no final packaging done in Alaska in the Bering Sea pollock. So if you got into other secondary processing where you're packaging and turning it into other product forms and that type of thing. By the way, this other tax credit was beneficial in that too. I know of several smaller processors that were able to get into other product forms. I mean, nothing exotic, but some of them that were able to expand their freezing capacity, for instance, and got out of can. And the benefits of that have been that on balance, the more diversity, the higher price the fishermen get for their product. The higher price the fishermen get for the product, the higher the taxes are, because the state taxes are based upon the ex-vessel price that the processor pays to the fisherman. So if you double the price to fishermen, not only is the fisherman happier, but the state's happier because they double their taxes. That's the way the state gets the benefit from this. The plants that were built over the long pull will far pay back the state for many times over for what the small tax credit will benefit.
The other thing that often comes up, and usually there are many times you'll get a so what when you ask the question, but or make the point, but you know, a lot of the shore plants in Alaska, as well as a lot of the factory trawlers, are not American owned, certainly not Alaskan owned, and why shouldn't we be concerned? Why should or shouldn't we be concerned about it? I'm sure that some of your members are Japanese companies that own shore-based plants in Alaska, so I understand where you're coming from, but like I've got this map over here, you've probably seen it, that shows, I'll put it up here, shows all the foreign-owned processing plants in Alaska, even partially owned. As well as all the trawlers that have some foreign ownership.
What is the map that said? Which shows
what? This just shows all the different processing plants that have some foreign ownership that go down Alaska. And for instance, Sans Souci is 100% Japan, 100%, 100%, 100% Japan, 37% Japan. 65 and 25, but it doesn't show any of the plants that don't have foreign ownership, like Trident, for instance, I think is all American, my understanding anyway. They're one of your members, aren't they?
They are.
And they've got a plant in Akatan, so they don't show up on the map. And I don't know, maybe
all those that are showing up have
some foreign ownership. All Alaskan seafoods, for instance, is 33% owned by English companies. So you can kind of get an idea. And look at the factory trawlers that are supposedly an American fleet now that are in some cases 100% owned by Japan, Korea, 66% owned by Norway,
So it's sort of a misnomer that this factory fleet's an American fleet, too. And I've always wanted to have an overlay there that would show the American companies, the ones that have no foreign ownership in Alaska. And but that's where it comes up. Somebody says, well, so what? I mean, who cares if it's foreign owned? Alaska still gets a benefit because of the economy they generate onshore and so forth. But I always thought it was worth knowing who you're helping. And I think the commerce people here said that, what, 30 or 40%, I don't know what it was, the people that took advantage of the tax credit were foreign companies. I don't know what the percentage was exactly, but something like that.
The definition of terms would be nice. In that report that was done for you, then Representative Cotton, they seem to flip back and forth between ownership of companies, control of companies, and stock ownership of companies. One of the ones I found rather laughable that was listed in the Japanese ownership or implying control was the fact that the Forge Gold Packing Company had, I forget what it was, 20% foreign ownership, as to somehow imply that that company, that 20% somehow controlled the Brindles, and I found that quite amusing somehow. I wondered if they ever even got on the board of directors with 20%. So, solely owned family corporation, that really didn't mean that. But some of the others were
this
not.
This one here, for instance, I mean, I don't even know if Word Cove shows up on there, but all it would have said was 20%.
Right, but the report seemed to bounce things back and forth between ownership of stock, ownership of the company, control of companies, and that type of thing. The other thing that, like you say, there's a significant number of companies. In fact, the two largest companies operating in the state of Alaska and two of the most aggressive companies operating in the state of Alaska are 100% American-owned. One of them largely owned by Alaskan fishermen, and that's Icicle Seafoods. The other one is Trident Seafoods, is also 100% American-owned, has substantial stock in it from ConAgra Corporation, but it's still an American corporation. Other than the Surimi plants, and those were constructed, at least the first two, by Japanese, because they were forced to do it under the fish and chips policy. They didn't want to build those plants. They were forced into it in order to be able to get directed fishery and joint venture fishery in the 200-mile zone. Now, since then, I think they found it's been a pretty good deal. But it wasn't any kind of a power grab on their part. It was something they were very reluctant to do. In fact, they didn't think that they were going to be able to turn out as good a product as they finally did. In the salmon or traditional seafood operations, I have not seen any interest in the foreign ownership. In fact, the opposite is true. There's been sales of Japanese or foreign-owned companies to others. Morpak, for instance, sold the Chugach Fisheries. That Morpak was Japanese-owned. Other than the acquisition of Pelican, which is a relatively small processing plant here in southeastern Alaska, I can't think of any significant Japanese movement into what I consider to be traditional fishing operations.
Peter Pan, that's not recent then.
Who?
Isn't Peter Pan?
Oh, if Peter Pan was, Peter Pan, that's an interesting one. I just came out of Bristol Bay for a meeting there a few weeks ago, and there was some comments about Japanese ownership there. I had to remind them that with a little institutional memory, that Peter Pan was a solely owned American company. It sold to an Alaskan company, the Bristol Bay Native Corporation, again, a solely American company. The Bristol Bay Native Corporation sold it to the Japanese. So it was rather interesting to me to then hear them complaining about Japanese involvement in the industry. I assume they did it because they made money at it, but why complain now? The other thing, if we don't want to have foreign ownership, then maybe what we ought to do is, for one thing, let's not send our governors and legislative delegations over these foreign nations encouraging them to come and invest in this country. And the next thing you can do immediately and save a hell of a lot of money is close that office in Tokyo. and let's send the message that we don't want to have to do business with them. And I think that that would be fine. Otherwise,
that's why I kind of was getting
that. So what's the problem?
Is there a problem with that? I mean, that's why I say, a lot of people say, so what if there's a foreign ownership there? And so I don't have a very good answer to that question. I say, well, geez, I don't know. I think it's nice to know, and it's nice to know who's getting benefits. We do give tax credits, but I'm with you. I mean, if we don't want them here, I imagine we could probably run them out if we didn't want them here.
The only thing I can tell you is that in my 20-some, 22, 23 years in working in this industry, and I have seen these companies under different ownership. But let's take Peter Pan, for instance, when it was owned by Nick Bez and the Bez family, then sold to the Bristol Bay Navy Corporation, and then sold to, who now owns it? Nichiro, I guess now. Whoever. And I knew the Bez family. I knew Jay Gage, who was running the company under the Bristol Bay Navy Corporation. And I know Bill Solitek, who's now the chief executive officer. I'll be damned if I can tell any difference the way the company's run. I mean, it seems to be run, and by the way, I don't think it's run any different than Trident Seafoods or Icicle Seafoods or anything else. They, if you looked at the way the companies are operated, one, they don't operate any differently regardless of who owns them, and they don't operate all that differently from any other company, whether they're Canadian-owned, whether they're Indonesian-owned, whether they're English-owned, or whether they're owned by Alaska Natives, or whether they're just owned by, you know, a conglomerate or whatever. They seem to operate about the same. You know, some are better than others, but I don't notice any relationship between the ownership and... The only thing I can tell is, regardless of who owns them, they try to go out and find the best people they can to run the company.
Yeah, well, it finally gets down to your other point. I think Fred makes a point, too, is if we're trying to do something that benefits Alaska, maybe what be that there's a company that's owned by a foreign company, that as a result of them being there, is where Alaska benefits, and that's...
Well, who owns it for Alaska, I guess, doesn't matter, as long as they pay their taxes, and as long as they create jobs, and as long as they... help provide a stable economy and that type of thing. Someone once told me that capital has no nationality. I'm sure it's a cliche in the financial circles, but from Alaska's point of view, all things being equal, I don't see that it makes an awful lot of difference. Obviously, I'd personally rather have every company in Alaska operating that's owned by Alaskans, but so far we haven't found Alaskans that want to buy these companies.
Why would you want that?
Because it makes it a lot easier to deal with you people.
I thought you were going to say you kind of had the same gut instincts that everybody does, but maybe not have a good reason for it.
No, mine would be the same thing. I've been fighting this battle of foreign ownership. Actually, before it was foreign ownership, and I thought what it meant... For many years, I was a lobbyist for the industry, and I thought foreign ownership, they were talking about Japanese, and then I found out they were talking about Seattle.
Rick, is there some way I could get information as to where the significant American plants are located so that I could make myself an overlay for a map like this?
Well, basically, that report that was done for you has that information in it. It would be easy for them to extract that. While they emphasized the plants that had some Japanese ownership or strike that, it was foreign ownership, it wasn't just Japanese.
Right.
And by the way, the drift is not toward Japanese ownership. The drift is towards Canadian and English ownership, by the way, if you want foreign involvement. There's not much Japanese involvement recently. They just take those companies, and obviously the ones that do not show up with foreign ownership then are American owned.
But you don't have like a list of plants in Alaska that are American owned?
No, I don't. And one of the dangers that we have with, for instance, you mentioned San Suu and so forth. I mean, a lot of these companies that are so-called Japanese-owned or American-owned, I mean, I never heard of them. I don't know who they are. They're not big players. I think the significance, if you're talking about who's players, is, as they say, you can have a whole bunch of companies. Peter Pan is fairly good-sized companies, but there's a whole bunch of them. Like, you couldn't put like Pelican Seafoods alongside of Trident,
right?
Or Icicle or something. I mean, you know, they've got 22 plants. Icicle has, or something like that. So it's how much do they process? Yeah. These companies buy $150 million worth of fish a year, or something like that. So.
Well, finally, and I appreciate the time I've taken on that, but you know, that's one of the arguments I hear from the factory trawlers, is that, the hell with you, we're the American fleet, and so why are you going to try to discriminate against us in favor of that Japanese-owned shore-based industry in Alaska? And so this is, I think, the important thing here for me that I learned. I knew there was a lot of foreign investment on shore Alaska, but I didn't realize the extent of the actual true foreign ownership of that factory trawler fleet. It's not American.
Well, there is significant ownership. The thing that the thing, if you're so American and you love Alaska so much, then why don't they come into Alaska and do business? The thing with these so-called, whether they're American-owned or foreign-owned companies based in Alaska onshore, is when they pay taxes, they pay raw fish taxes. Factory trawlers don't pay a dime raw fish tax to the state of Alaska. By the way, they don't pay a dime raw fish tax to the federal government either. They don't pay a dime raw fish tax to Unalaska, Pribilofs, Sand Point, or any other place that has sales taxes. Bristol Bay or wherever where they're salmon. All those have 2 or 3% sales taxes. They don't pay any property taxes, real property taxes. And if there's ever an income tax, they won't pay any income tax in the state of Alaska. They don't pay any corporate income tax now, and our employees will never pay any. So you say, well, this is wonderful. They're American. Well, as far as the 200-mile limit and the promise that it provided us in 1976, we thought, boy, Alaska, we're really going to benefit from it. If the factory trawlers win, as far as Alaska is concerned, we might as well have it go to the foreigners. We won't see any of it. They'll be offshore. You won't even see them. And they don't have any connection with, or insignificant amount of connection with Alaska. So it's not a matter of who owns the companies. It's what does it do to benefit the infrastructure of Alaska, the overall benefit to the state? It's sure not the factory trawlers.
Well, I'm tempted to try to get into a different subject here and try to leave to you as to how to get benefit out of those, but I think I'd be drifting off the subject.
Yeah, well, the chairman's been very kind to us to get into this dialogue now.
You know, Mr. Chairman, we did basically the same type of study back in the early 80s, trying to figure out the ownership. And when you start looking at then at the ownership, if you want to call ownership or the same as an investor, there's not much difference. You could not get American investors into, you can't get General Motors or anybody else to invest in there or any of our banks. I mean, if you're going to run a business and get into it in the competitive business that they're in like this, you've got to go to where the money is. And a lot of it, the money that was available was from foreign countries. And that's just, that was the bottom line. We see so many small, struggling companies there that are trying to do it as family operations, and they absolutely cannot compete. One thing Rick left out of here is your offshore fleet do not have to put up with the same rules and regulations there that you do with a shore-based plant. You've got, on a shore-based plant, you've got inspectors on you all the time, you've got EPA down on you all the time, you've got DEC on you all the time, and, plus whatever local ordinances are on top of that. And, it's just absolute, carte blanche out there on the high seas. It gets so frustrating every time you try to do something for the fishing industry in here that you've got to go through this ritual every time of ownership. And, there is a difference between ownership and ownership investors. And this is, this is where the money's been made available. I mean, if I wanted to open up a business and I couldn't get the money out of a bank downtown and somebody in Germany wanted to loan me the money, and I certainly wouldn't say, well, I'm sorry, I want to make this an all-American business, What am I going to do? It just doesn't make sense.
Senator Cotton. Well, I said it, but this is my last question. Do you think that there's any, you know, you hear a lot of speculation, but it's been suggested that if you're a Japanese company in Alaska, and I use Japan because that's the biggest market for our fish, you're in better shape to get that fish to market and get a good price for it than if you're an Alaskan-owned mom-and-pop fish company. You've got to then figure out how to get that fish to the market, which is Japan. Is there an inherent advantage to having a connection with the market? I mean, like, if the British and the Canadians are coming in, and that means that they're probably trying to service the British market. I mean, is it a big advantage, you think, that to be a British company if you're trying to sell fish to Britain?
I would imagine it might be helpful to be a British company selling fish to Britain, but, and I think it would probably be an advantage to know your way around Japan, including being Japanese-owned and doing business there, if that's where you intend to sell. I don't think it's a disadvantage at all. I also don't think that it's necessary for Japanese buyers to have fishing companies, fish processing companies in Alaska in order to do business. As I mentioned, the two largest, the two giants in this industry that sell, I would imagine those two must sell more than all of the Japanese companies combined, don't have a dime of Japanese or any other foreign money in them. So I'm not going to say that it's not an advantage, but it's obviously not necessary in order to do business. And they do quite nicely. They have their problems and frustrations with doing business in those foreign countries. But we have problems, if not just Oriental countries. The European Economic Community is not the easiest place to do business with these days either. So I'm sure that somebody has in there might be easier for them to do business than it would be for another
company. Okay, thank you. Senator Bernard, you had a question for Commerce and Economic Development.
Revenue.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Paul Dick, representing the Department of Revenue. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
In the data that you've put out here in the on the one sheet where you're talking about the 89th Fisheries Business Tax Credit, so when we're looking at these columns here of expenditures of $61,400,000, the tax credit claimed of $13 million. For the 89. So, what is the total amount of tax that was collected in that year?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Menard, the total fishery business tax collected for calendar year 1989, FY90 revenues was approximately $38 million.
And then, 50% of that $38 million is distributed back to the communities.
Mr. Chairman, why? Not in all cases. Sometimes only the cases where there is processing within a municipal or borough boundary does that get shared back. And we do have several cases where floating processors, for example, are processing outside of a city or borough boundary. In that case, it all goes to the state. Except for the tax credit is still applicable. So it's possible to where the state may retain 50% of the total revenue collected. However, that's not subject to the revenue sharing program. We wouldn't share that back.
Senator Frank. Yeah, on that, we did last year pass a bill that would share the 50% of fish taxes in areas outside of boroughs with cities. Outside boroughs, and that there's a new interpretation by the department, and I'm not sure exactly what it is, but there is a bill introduced by the Senate President today to correct that. And if that bill passes, starting in 1993, I believe it is, then 50% of the fish tax revenues would be distributed either to boroughs or cities. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frank, that portion that not previously shared would be allocated amongst communities based on an allocation formula that the community in which all figures would administer. We would transmit, we would identify those monies not shared, previously shared, and transmit that money over to the Department of Community and Regional Affairs. And they are developing formula with communities around the state as to the allocation method.
But they would wind up with 50% going back to
yes.
communities, right?
Total on that thing, if the bill passes, then there would be 50%. So then on the 50% remaining, then has it been typical that all the monies go out on tax credit applications?
Mr. Chairman, it doesn't happen all the time. I'm not sure the percentage of occurrence on that. It does happen where there are credits against that non-municipal shared money. I'm not sure as to the extent of that amount.
Mr. Chairman?
How much of that goes back?
Senator Frank?
I think like in 89, if you said that there was 38 million, took half of 38, you're looking at 19. If all of 19 was shared, then 13 is claimed as a credit, so the state would be left somewhere on the order of 5 or 6 in the general fund. Something like that. That's because not all companies made capital investments of a great enough degree to capture their full 50%.
Okay, I just wanted to get an idea of what we were talking about as far as the dollar amount.
I have one other question. I just want to make sure I understand this. The sheet following it for January 18th of 1990, the carry forward, it says 32 million in tax credits carried forward. Is that correct?
Yes.
And those would be eligible for to be claimed if this bill passed. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frank, these would be carry forwards from.
Oh, from previous.
From previous
right.
years.
Okay.
And so this new bill would be another program.
I got you. So even if we didn't pass this bill, there would still be, they could still claim credits for previous years in carrying forward if they made the investment prior to the expiration of the last program.
That's right.
Okay.
I think the way that the program was set up, you had a 3-year period in which to get into it. And
to make sure
you got into it.
Yeah.
Right. And then you could work that over the next 3-year period. So this is why, you know, you didn't have the program last year, but then you still have, I think it would be the last year of program that was started 2 years earlier.
So just to follow that up, then we would expect that our tax revenues would be reduced by that $32 million. Is that correct? Or would all of it not be likely to be recovered by the companies that could claim those credits?
Mr. Chairman, over a 2-year period, this is a carryover from calendar year 1989. Calendar year 1990 returns were due March 31st of this year. So that's going to go into FY91. They will and have used credits that is going to reduce this $32 million for our annual report next year. There will be a residual balance for carry forward to be used on the calendar year 1991 returns.
But for 90,
if all 32 million dollars will be used over the 2-year period.
So, but it's probably likely that roughly half would get used in 91 or 90 and half in 91 or something like that, or at least commensurate with what we've got here in 89, which is 13 million.
That's right.
Anybody else like to testify?
Chairman, do you want a motion to adopt the CS?
We'll close the hearing and and what we're working off of is the Labor and Commerce CS. So, this point on the motion, move it.
Mr. Chairman, I'd make a motion that we move the CS for Senate Bill 27 out with the individual recommendations as unanimous consent.
We no object this order. Now we move on to substitute for Hospital 49 slowly from DBT based pain.
Thank you, Senator. For the record, my name is Barnaby Dow, and I'm the staff of Representative Fran Ulmer. I'm sorry if she was unable to make it right now. She's in the Finance Committee. I guess they're considering the SBS situation, so I'm able to get away. HB 49 deals with TBT-based pains. A lot of you have probably dealt with this issue in the past, so I won't try to bother you too much with the details. HB 49 simply changes the testing standard for TBT-based pains in order to conform with the new federal regulations. TBT is an ingredient widely used in marine-based pains to prevent the growth of barnacles and algae on boat hulls. It also happens to be highly toxic. In 1987, this legislature passed a bill and joined three other West Coast states in sharply reducing amounts of TBT based in paint that can be sold in stores. Unfortunately, the testing standard for TBT, which trips the ban for its sale here in Alaska, is just 1 microgram per centimeter per day, which is a release rate lower than the standard that has since been established by the EPA and adopted by these other western states, California, Oregon, and Washington. So as a result, many marine paints which meet the new federal requirement aren't allowed to be sold here in Alaska, which is apparently turning aluminum boat owners predominantly into criminals because they buy the paint in Seattle and bring it up here and apply it to their boats. The new bill would solve the problem by changing the level to meet the EPA standard. Several organizations that lobbied strenuously for the lower standards back in 1987, including the Pacific Fisheries Legislative Task Force, now support matching the state standard with the new federal level. Marine paint distributors, specifically from Petersburg, here in Juneau, and in Ketchikan, have all contacted our office saying that this legislation would also allow them to sell these paints. The task force says the new standard still effectively curbs the threat to marine life while allowing commerce to continue without undue risk. I believe there might be someone from the DEC here available to testify if you have any questions.
Questions from committee?
We're going to paint bars this summer.
There was no opposition in the House to this.
Yeah. Was the, are the furries painless, did they used to be painless kind of stuff?
Mr. Chairman, it's possible that they used to be. They are no longer now. The TBT is
the Navy still used to.
Yeah, if they ever repaint them, they're not allowed to. But TBT based paints are used predominantly with aluminum boats. Apparently, there's something about aluminum and TBT that go well together. And it's your small boat owner that is affected, and small commercial fishermen.
We understand how this brings us to current federal law.
That's correct. The wording of the bill, language of which was changed slightly in the Labor and Commerce version, which is before you now, simply states that the state of Alaska will now be in compliance with the EPA standard, which is all other coastal states comply with at this moment.
So now what happens if somebody comes up from Washington with this on their bottom?
They're not there in Washington that way. They believe Louisiana had come
up with that. Yeah. The law only applies to its sale here in Alaska, so technically you're only in violation if you were to buy it in Washington, bring it up here, and then apply it to your boat.
Okay.
questions?
Close the hearing.
Move to pass the bill out as soon as it's set.
Any objections ordered?
Thank you very much.
That'll take care of today. Anything further? Not. We stand adjourned.
What's left big on our agenda here?